My conversation today is with veteran practitioner and host of the Magic Without Fears Hermetic podcast, Frater RC. Among several other topics, he and I sat down today to talk about the Golden Dawn tradition of magic, with which he is intimately familiar, the angelic sessions of John Dee and Edward Kelly, and podcasting, as he has been host and interviewer to some of the most well-respected and serious practitioners in the magical and occult communities spanning several generations and lineages. We also spoke about the 2024 EnochiaCon, which Frater RC has organized, and is taking place this July in Vancouver, Canada, where he's based. Though only having recently met Frater RC, I can say I found an easy friend and kindred spirit. I'm Ike Baker, and this is the Arcanum Podcast. Very good. Very good. All right. Awesome. I am so stoked that you are here right now, Frater RC, from the Magic Without Fears Hermetic podcast. We just started talking recently, but, you know, I'm a fan of your work. You've been listening to the pod, which I really appreciate. And we've got a lot of areas of, you know, confluence and harmony and, I'm just happy to be able to talk to you. Now, the one thing that I want to start off with for my listeners is how did you get into magic and the occult? When did you know that you're like, okay, I'm committed to this?
The commitment came after a forest fire disaster we had in Penticton, British Columbia. This was 94. And we had to get rushed out of the Pizza Hut we were in. I guess I would have been 13, 14. And the whole mountain range was on fire, and the city was in imminent fear of evacuation as one of the biggest home burning disasters all up. It's one of the biggest fire disasters we've had. We've had a lot more since, of course, but that this one still charts. And I was watching the fires and the flames, just it was godlike, right? It was just absolutely overwhelming. And as I was doing that, just watching it from our campsite on our summer vacation, all of a sudden, like, I just, while I was watching the fire, and I'd been meditating for years, doing transcendental meditation by at this point, but not much else at all. I didn't really, you know, other than that, for me it was mostly, you know, Dungeons and Dragons and Magic the Gathering and stuff in those early 90 years. But watching that fire up there, and just something came alive, and I actually felt like all of a sudden my whole, like, the space around me just opened up, and there was like fire all around me, and there's like fire above my head, and I was like, there's this light on above my head. And I think something switched on that just the next day I woke up and I was like, there's a voice in my head said, you're going to be an occultist. You have to be an occultist. I was like, what does that mean? I didn't even know what it meant. I'd come across the word, but no clue, really. I know my mom had a book by Rudolf Steiner called The Outline of Occult Science, but I had no idea what it was, let alone how it connected to the Waldorf school I was attending. And that day we met up with her boyfriend, who was like one of the top dogs in Amwork, and he took us to her a cult shop that his friend owned, and I bought Celtic Magic by DJ Conway and a bunch of little potions and oils and ointments, and we all bought lots of books, and I just didn't stop reading. I had already, by that point, when I was 10, lived in an OTO oasis. So I wasn't, I don't know, the vibe was already strong in my life. And again, getting initiated at like age 7 and 10 into the ceremonies for transcendental meditation, like those are full initiations. Like it's like, whether you look at it, is it ancestor magic or attuning the meditator to the spirits of the mantra, which is something I don't want to say more than that, because I don't want to spoil TM for those who are still taking it very seriously. And there's nothing wrong with it as far as I can tell. The organization, of course, has the same problems as any human groups. But yeah, so that was the moment that the commitment and the path and the calling hit me like a lightning bolt and never changed. Yeah, but my interest, of course, there was some interest there before that. I just was too young and didn't know enough to make sense of it, I guess.
Yeah, that is very young. That's very young. I feel like I'm like almost jealous that he got in so young, because there's I personally feel like I started behind the eight ball. I mean, I started reading about this stuff, I want to say just out of high school, or maybe like my senior year of high school. But it's like you have to wade through that period of I don't know what I believe. And then there's so many different competing, I want to say, perceptual softwares that you are unaware of. You got to get through the whole psychologization thing and realize, like, oh, that's the thing. That's not actually how it was, before the 19th century. And then you're trying to figure out, well, is it this whole reenchantment thing? And then how am I, trying to filter magic through this postmodern kind of thing that I've just been literally like steeped in, like a bag of tea, like my entire young adult life. So it took a long time, and I know that it takes a long time for a lot of people to kind of figure that stuff out and get all the cognitive dissonance kind of like just knocked out of their head. So I'm sure that probably put you on really good footing for just being able to spend your adult years, I'm assuming, right? Kind of just getting to where you are now, a little bit more of an informed and scholarly approach, but also a practitioner.
Yeah, the academic stuff didn't come along really until early 2000s. I was reading things like Francis Yates in the late 90s and 2000, because it was being republished in very accessible and popular ways. But the academic side, like I didn't start reading things like Antoine Fevre and Hanegraaff and Jocelyn Godwin until after I closed Temple Tahuti in 2003, 4. And so yeah, no, I went my entire career in the Golden Dawn without being even really remotely aware of the academic study of Western esotericism. I mean, obviously you see some of these guys' names in their books in the store, and then you look at it and it looks really dense and you're like, oh, this is a boring writer. Where's his exercises for telekinesis? And you don't really grok that it's a university thing, like that this is actually a university peer-reviewed book. And you're like, once you realize that and what that is and what that means, you're like, oh, they're really taking this stuff seriously. That's actually kind of cool. Maybe I can learn something from that. But from 1996, when I was initiated into Neophyte at Temple Tahuti, to 1999, when I tested into Portal in my 12th year of grade 12 year of high school, and then as an adept 18 months later, 5, 6, I was 18 months in Portal, and had to double my working for that to really work through stuff because I was so young. And I'm glad I wasn't initiated into 5, 6 at 19. It makes sense that I was waited till I was 20. They were waiting for me to like have girlfriends and have a life and mature in certain ways that I was holding off on. What they didn't realize was like I was staying a virgin intentionally because of all the stuff I'd read about virgins being better scryers. And my psychic senses were pretty on point, honestly, to the point that I could demonstrate stuff to people very, very well, and always knew who was calling on the phone, even if they were supposed to be out of town. That sort of stuff was
I
very
got it.
prominent in my life.
I gotta tell you, and I have to support that thing. When I take, people will roll their eyes, they'll scoff, they'll laugh. I don't really give a shit. But the truth is, when I am completely abstinent for long periods of time and things like that, I am more in tune. I'm more intuitive. It's just more available to me. Now, I mean, I didn't get into practical magic before I, kind of that ship had sailed, virginity, type thing. So I don't know what it would be like, but that must have been an incredible and overwhelming experience for a young guy.
Well, it's certainly the progress that me and my little high school Wiccan coven of two buddies were able to make in seeing how far we could take these things was phenomenal and remarkable, and gave and solidified me in the experience that this stuff was all very real, like seeing spirits for real outside your circle on Midsummer Sabbat celebration, where you're doing your high school coven thing. Like, that's not psychological. So when the whole psychological thing became understanding of magic reared its ugly head, I was a little surprised and confused by it. But now I understand it. I know where it came from. I know how it developed. And it's like, now my take on that is, if you want to think it's all in your head psychologically, we can't just say all in your head after Lon Milo has clarified that he agrees with Steven Skinner. Yeah. On my podcast, right? He doesn't believe in the psychological model. So, but if that model's fine, because if you're doing everything right, then and well, inevitably, you'll probably have that dispelled if you're meant to, right? You know, if you do it well enough, long enough, you'll probably have a spirit turn up or get some phenomena that convince you otherwise, or at least suggest otherwise.
And then if you're still like, if you still need to cling on to that psychological model, you'll probably just think you're losing your mind.
You maybe, <know? laughs> but I think also Israel Regardi did an excellent job at demonstrating the psychological benefit of the system, regardless of your metaphysical views of it. And to me, that's one of the greatest things about Regardi.
Absolutely. But you know what? Another thing that he said was he was kind of insistent on, if you're going through this kind of stuff and you're having, you know, the alchemical initiations of the Golden Dawn, not just that, but just practicing magic in general, you should be seeing a psychotherapist, which, you know, he thought that those two tracks together would be very healthy. And I don't doubt that they are. I'm not sure that modern psychotherapy is, you know, in the main, I'm not sure that it's anything more than behaviorism at this point. I'm also not a professional, and I've been out of therapy for a couple of years. So, I don't really know, but I could see how those two things, you know, especially could you imagine having Israel Regardi as like your psychotherapist? You know, like that would be such a blessing if you're a magician, because this guy would he'd not try to talk you out of it.
Yeah, I guess I did a year of therapy and then another year, 10 years apart. The first time it was a guy who had a PhD and specialized academically in medieval mysticism. So we had a great time.
Wow.
Especially after I'd worked through the trauma. And by the end, like the last few months, where we would just talk about like Meister Eckhart and stuff. And until eventually I was like, I think we're good. And he's like, yeah, I think we're good. Come visit sometime. And then, you know, 10 years later, I had to do another year, and that helped. You know, I think talk therapy can help people get through trauma and catastrophe, especially if they don't have support networks or family who are willing to listen. So if you just don't have those things, then it can be really great. And of course, I can't even comment on really the quality of talk therapy. I just don't know enough.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly did. It did wonders for me at a certain point in my life. Absolutely. You know, I spent, from the time I was about in fourth grade, I had been in therapy all through high school and stuff like that, even in college. So I'm not knocking it, but it's just one of the reasons why I'll sometimes kind of dig my feet about going, you know, dig my heels in about going back, is like, if this is such a huge part of my life that like, how the hell am I not going to talk about, you know, it's like trying to hide, I don't know. It's like trying to hide the fact that maybe like you're a paraplegic from your therapist. Like, there's no way I can hide this from you. But it sounds like you may have been sort of like made for this life. Between all the kind of synchronicities and the experiences and things like that, it seems like this was kind of part of your life path, you know, from a really early age.
Yeah, I think so. You know, it seems to be a part of what my mother calls my dharma. And I've thought a lot about the course of my life, and it's amazing how much was influenced by health, honestly. And it's something I will dig into later at some point. But you know, like I found out only in my early 30s that I had celiac disease. So when puberty hit, I didn't understand why all of a sudden all my joints hurt, why I was putting on weight. I couldn't run anymore without my ankles giving out. And so I went from being like the athlete kid in the school to being this fat, depressed goth kid, you know, hiding his head in Anne Rice in the hopes that my classmates in grade 8, the girls wouldn't all like decided to beat me up that recess because we was like two guys in our class and 10 girls. And
Oh,
so
wow.
it got a bit rough. That was a dark period. My parents divorced and all that. And it was hell on earth. And magic really saved me. Spirituality saved me.
Yes.
And I
Yeah.
needed something different than transcendental meditation because that's what my parents did. That's what they brought me into. And when they divorced and stopped doing it, life was hellish for a few years, especially with a wicked stepmother coming into the picture, like evil beyond belief.
Wow.
So I couldn't turn to TM because it was mentally, it was associated with all that. So I found my way to Celtic magic and then just magic, just trying to understand what this magic thing is. And that of course led me to the Golden Dawn. I couldn't learn it from books. You have to have
No.
people.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So how did podcasting get into it?
I tried to do a few podcasts in like 2008 and 2019, but didn't really seem to take off. And then I started another one in 2020 early on because I was doing a presentation. I'm very honored to have been accepted by the PantheaCon panel and got to invited to go present there in 2020 in February, right when COVID hit. So I got the Delta variant the beginning on a Monday and was presenting on a Friday at PantheaCon, not knowing that I had just was still like probably contagious from the Delta variant. I didn't even know I had COVID at the time, but I did feel like I was dying. Yeah, that was a, probably a super spreader event that I was very honored to be a part of. I did a presentation on W.B. Yeats's Hermetic Order of Celtic Mysteries and had a great event. Got to hang out with Lon and Chicken Tabby. I got to like, yeah, chill with Chicken Tabby and Lon all at the same time. I'll send you a pic.
That's
We all
amazing.
had a fireside chat about some of our favorite people in the world, you know, like David Griffin and others.
Yep, I would
Too,
love to have
hope
been a
that's not
fly
too
on
wild
that
for this
wall,
podcast.
man. I would love to have been a fly on that wall. Yeah, so I mean, you're a Golden Dawn guy. I know most people know that about you. We were talking a bit about how the tradition is kind of experiencing, I don't know, what is it, a resurgence? I mean, what is it? What's going on right now?
I honestly think a lot of it is to do with things opening up. And not, I'm not talking about in the secular world in COVID and all that. I'm talking about just in the traditions. So we've had the traditions and the different branches of the main branches of the order locked down for a very long time, right? There was this in my day, especially I'll speak when I speak of the Cicero group, which of course you're a part of, I'm going to speak about it from the my knowledge of it back in the day. So this, what I heard about it, because there wasn't much information going around. And
Right.
most of what I knew was from gossip from people who were talking to them on the phones in our inner order. And so they weren't really recruiting at all, of course. And so, Hogdi and Homsi and EOGD then were recruiting hardcore, and our order became had thousands of members in it, and major temples, and Temple Tehuti, the one that I ran, it was over 125 active members, 24/7, two temples inside, massive, beautiful, everything, in a horrible part of town, the light in the darkness, right next to the same strip club from Deadpool, and it was a wild experience, but really beautiful, and really, everyone was very devoted to it. But those traditions, the the sort of Zinc and Griffin and the other branches, for whether it's Chris Monastra or now the orders temples connected with Zaleski, I think there just wasn't that many options. But those orders produced adepts, right? And a lot of those adepts moved on. Some of them stopped being interested in this stuff, but some of them didn't, right? Like the amount of Golden Dawn adepts that are floating around BC and Canada. They came out of Thuban Temple and are now just have no one to talk to or even connect with or work with is crazy. So most of them are probably just going to take those skills and apply them to the rest of their lives. That's what I was doing up until I came back on the scene in 2019, just applying what I knew to my life. And I think that's not a bad thing for a magician to do, is just take their knowledge, gnosis, and skills and live their best life with it. You don't have to always be attached to these organizations. And like you were saying, with all the collecting sashes, that's not necessarily what it has to be. It's a wonderful part of it, especially if you really love the initiations and putting on the initiations and believe in that experience and sharing it with others. So now there's all these other people and they're creating groups, and you have independent groups and temples that are springing up and creating more opportunities. Why there is more of a demand than we can fulfill is something I'm not quite sure. Maybe you have some ideas, because there's way more people wanting to be initiated into go into a good, even decent Golden Dawn temple than we could ever fulfill at present, right? Like if me and my friends in town were to even put on initiations, we could never even tell anyone, because there'd be too many people who want to do it. And if you're sticking with one person, one candidate per initiation, which is probably the only way I'll do it ever again. And we instituted that change while I was an adept at Tahuti. So, and that was the right move, I think. I'm not opposed to group initiations. I don't think there's anything wrong with them, but they're not preferable.
Yeah, especially on the, for lack of a better term, the astral load on the dais and stuff like that. You're doing a lot of stuff up there. If you're working the Zed formulas and it, I don't know. Maybe I'm gonna out myself as a little bit of a wuss, but it gets exhausting like quick. So it's like I'm like, marathon initiate. Our Golden Dawn day is like for the Temple Chiefs. I mean, it's basically, it's a 12-hour day almost. So
Oh yeah. And heaven help you if it's like a 3-8 or 4-7 and you haven't finished all your lines. Like there's times, especially when you're running a full-time temple, where your officers fortunately are well trained. Everyone, your crew of 6 months has been well honed, ready for that first 4-7, and you have to just lock yourself in your room, walk back and forth, reading the lines backwards and frontwards, however you can, to memorize them so you don't have that script on the dais with you. And it's just
Yes.
to memorize that amount of information sometimes in 1 or 2 days is incredible. But I'm pleased to say you can do it.
Yeah, well, that was, believe it or not, the memory load thing actually came to me later on when I joined Freemasonry, because there's you that is the real, for me, that's the memory training right there. In order to move through, and I'm not certain that it's this way in every jurisdiction in the States, but I know in mine you have to complete proficiency, which is about 15 minutes of dialogue with a coach completely from memory, in archaic English, like English that no one uses anymore. But that really it really did help a lot of the ritual work later on. And when you get up to those, I guess, higher grades in the Outer Order, where there are less officers, but there's more paths. So it's like you've got like three or four really solid people, but after the second or third, you're just kind of like, maybe you're warming up if you're doing, an early 4-7 and then working your way down. But by the time you're doing like two or three neophytes, like the middle of the day or the end of the day, you're just like, Jesus Christ, I'm exhausted. I think I need like a
Are you
power bar.
actually talking about doing the 0-0 three times in a row?
Yeah. I
Yeah,
mean,
yeah,
because
yeah. Yeah.
we'll do group initiations, but there's certain point, because it's like you're saying, the demand is too high. And in a lot of ways, it's like you have to keep bringing in new neophytes as the demand comes to the door. I mean, like Chick's big thing is like you got to give everybody a chance to come to the light. So we do,
In the
we
last few months, I gotta say, in the last few months of our temple, like our membership before I closed it down was going through the roof. Like we were having months where it was 4 members joining, 9 members giant joining, 5 members joining. Like we would have been at hundreds of members, which would have given us the ability to change locations or do incredible things. It's just it felt it just it wasn't working. It
Yeah,
wasn't
and
working.
there's certain points of that ritual where it has to be just the candidate. You can't be
That's
doing.
what they say.
Yeah. I mean, I can't do it any other way. There's certain points, you know, there's like the fourth and final purification and all that stuff. There's no way you can have like a bunch of people like holding each other's shoulders, you know, like some other
Speaking of,
rituals.
yeah, well, yeah, we would sometimes, because we were, if on the nights we did multiple initiations for, like, if we had two people, we would sometimes finish one at 2 a.m. You know, it'd be a lot. But I was one of those people that you hear about in the neophyte initiation, who was like incredibly psychic before it, and then as soon as, like, after that whole the whole sword thing, psychic senses gone, felt more in my body than I ever had. And like, I felt like a prisoner in my body for the first time in my life. Like, there's no, I'm not even a mind, right? I'm just this lump of flesh. And that didn't shift back, and that I didn't reawaken with my senses until 3-8. Yeah.
That, I mean, that's crazy. I had shut a lot of that stuff off because I was scared when I was a kid. I used to, my parents divorced as well, and you know, I felt completely insecure without my dad in the house. And but we moved into this place that was just not, it was not comfortable. Too much going on there. I don't know what it was, what kind of trauma was going on, but I would see people in the hallways and stuff like that, and it just scared the shit out of me. And I had to shut it off in order to function as, like, you know, a 13-year-old. Like, you don't have enough going on, you know, with puberty and middle school and things like that. So, but it actually, the floodgates opened after my neophyte. And then I would say probably once I hit portal, they kind of closed back. Everything started to even out. Maybe probably 4 = 7, the philosophers. Everything started to kind of even out again. And now I can kind of, I can access it. You know, I've developed other techniques. I work a lot of like Taoist energy work. You know, that was, there were like two parallel streams that just ran next to each other the entire time. It seemed kind of like we're talking a little. It was my dharma to do both of those at the same time, and so I utilized those to kind of create my own coin, each one being either side, and I kind of I can access these things with more control now, but it's just really interesting because I don't get to really talk. I mean, I talk to people that are in the Golden Dawn tradition, but not at this level. So this is a great conversation for me. I'm really enjoying this.
Yeah, like we were saying before you hit record, there's not that many people who have ever lived to run a Golden Dawn temple at all. And so it's fascinating to be able to talk with each other. I can only imagine the things we would all say if you got a group of us from different orders in person and just hanging out. But hopefully we're working hard to create in-person communities and events that will actually allow more camaraderie and sharing between people. So hopefully that happens and we get to hang out.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, leading to my next question, that's an excellent segue. Enochian being essentially the capstone of the Golden Dawn system of magic, you've got the Enochiacon that you're putting on this year in Vancouver, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's the first of what will be four.
Yeah, the theme for these 4 years, we can always have a different theme after that, but let's just get this thing going and see what happens, right? So for the next 3 years, the goal is to have it in Vancouver and build up to having the fourth year in Prague for John Dee's 500th birthday on July 13th. So this year will not be his 500th birthday, but we'll have a little birthday party for him here in Vancouver at the conference anyway. And yeah, I look forward to also aiming towards moving a fourth one in Europe. Allows us the ability to more easily invite the European scholars like Dr. Stephen Skinner and Dr. Egil Asperum and Dr. Gyorgy Zsunyi. I'm sure I'm butchering the name, but maybe not. Yeah, they're some really good, and there's other European experts that would be really great to have involved. So yeah, the idea is just to make events happen now that flight prices have dropped significantly from the last several years. It's doable to make these things happen and bring people together and let us share the best of our research and experience with each other. That's the
Yeah.
idea.
So are you a bit more of a D purist in your praxis, or have you spent any significant amount of time really trying to work the GD, I guess, reimagining of the system?
Yeah, no, like our dear brother Aaron Leach, I sort of stopped with GD Enochian at the pyramids with the Egyptian gods. I'm sure I'll do them at some point to justify a 6-5 ceremony, or something. Who knows? I don't know what's going to happen in the future, but yeah, no, the purism is what got me, and I have a course on it to get more people into it. So you can go to enochiangrimoire.com to get my intro course to depurism. But you know, the purists, here's the fun discussion about depurism, and I like the word traditionalism or traditional approach more, but that's vaguer. With purism, purism is, definitely includes, we've decided, the committee met and we took votes and everyone decided that purism does include Thelemic practitioners and non-Christian practitioners. So that means what I'm actually involved in is, for lack of a better term, dogmatic purism, right? As in, don't throw out D's religion and context. So the course I present is not requiring people be Christian to do that, because you can replace God with Mod, and you can replace any you could replace Jesus Christ with MAD for the Enochian name for God, or whatever other name you want. People do that anyway, so it seems silly to be like, actually, that's not true. Like, you know, come on. The goal is to get people not interested in being a Christian Enochian magician, heaven forbid, but you know Christ is king. Just joking, just joking. That whole internet stuff, oh my God, keep it away from me. Okay, keep but the goal is to get people interested in these actual writings and actual original forms of practice that would have been continued by his followers, quote unquote followers, all the way through Elias Ashmole and maybe Peter Smart and the other people who kept Enochian going, because those people, that tradition is what led to the cipher manuscripts. When the gold, everyone's always like, it's Golden Dawn Enochian. It's like, yes, the Golden Dawn created a system of Dee and Kelly's angel magic, and they named it Enochian magic, which would mean anything that comes after Golden Dawn Enochian would technically be Neo-Enochian, and Golden Dawn with methodology would be the only technically named Enochian magic, if you see what I'm saying with the terminology here. I'm giving a little challenge to Aaron Leach's categorizations there, just to you know, because I think it's because I think I'm right. But you know, it doesn't really matter. That what matters is where are you getting your sources from. And the Golden Dawn got their sources from the cipher manuscripts. So the Golden Dawn and Mathers are not the people responsible for saying we're going to divide the tablets, like you hear in all these everyone say, like, Mathers is the genius who divided the Great Table into four tablets and put them on the walls. And it's like, a little bit, but have you read the cipher manuscripts? Someone else, and Dr. Burns contends that whoever wrote them knew, understood the elemental alchemical progression of the Golden Dawn grades from the Monus Hieroglyphica of John Dee, and
Wow.
that the Monus Hieroglyphica in it contains the exact elemental progression and alchemical stages that we see then executed in the Golden Dawn system via the cipher manuscripts. It's very important people not forget the ciphers when looking at the origin of Golden Dawn stuff. And of course, Skinner's book, Practical Angel Magic, shows the text, the original 9,000 word document that may was probably Dee's prayers, but then expanded to almost 100,000 words, and then the Golden Dawn chunk at the back of this tiny little piece. But largely that's due to the fact that I think a lot of the GD stuff was burned by temples when they closed. That's why we don't have the Mathers lessons and instructions for adepts on traveling the aethers in the spirit vision, or working with the Heptarchia as the 7 days of creation. Of course, Nick Farrell's done a wonderful job letting us know that frequent references in Golden Dawn diary entries show that these lessons did exist. They just probably got burned, or who knows, maybe someone has them.
Well, that's the whole thing, right? That we hope that in future years, new evidence comes to light. And there's a lot of private collection sort of stuff, you know. And I don't know. I think didn't they found like what they're thinking are Westcott's tablets, like this. I think he did
Yeah,
like
Tabby did a whole book on it, right? She
Exactly. The
famous,
Concourse of the
they're selling
Force.
them. They're beautiful. I think they're psychedelic and fun.
They found them. Didn't they found that in like a broom closet in the museum or something like that? So.
No.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly, but the story was like incredible. Like how did nobody know this was in there? It was literally in like a museum or something.
No.
But
The other good thing about the purist approach or the traditional approach to Enochian magic is, while the Golden Dawn in Enochian magic really works well within the system and context of the Golden Dawn, right? And using these elemental powers as the cipher manuscripts describe the tablets to be elemental, right? In the tracing of the hierophant shapes and the names called, that's all the cipher manuscripts. That wasn't Mathers. So learning that doesn't really introduce you to much other than the Golden Dawn. Doesn't introduce you to what Dee and Kelly were up to. It might, though, be a reflection of the tradition of Enochian angel magic practitioners up until the point of the Golden Dawn. But by taking it back to Dee, of course, the diaries come alive again when you take it back to Dee and don't just efface it and say, oh, well, it doesn't matter because we've moved on. You might still find some stuff in there, as
Yeah.
many of us are. Like if you want to be a pioneer in any magical discipline, Dee Purism is a good place to go because there's a lot. He was a genius. And he was a fan of hiding things, and he was a fan of word plays, puns, secrets, right? Like even in the Monus Hieroglyphica, one of my favorite parts that Dr. Burns goes over is in the shape of the circle of the sun of the monad. Dee makes reference to ellipses, but then because he references one of them, he asks forgiveness of His Majesty for saying this because it shouldn't be known, and that's because he's describing the difference in that symbol in that sentence between how you use a parabola to chart an accurate firing of a cannonball versus an inaccurate one. And that is actually a secret that he therefore asked forgiveness from the queen for writing in this book that so, because some might understand what he's actually saying. And it's like, so he had this multi-layered mind that most of us probably couldn't even begin to fathom. And so looking at Enochian and involving yourself in the practice of Enochian magic from that a traditional purist perspective not only opens up Dee and Kelly in a whole new way than that we won't even begin to understand publicly for decades, but it opens up grimoire magic because the methods of Enochian are the methods we find in a compound version of Trithemian, drawing spirits into crystals, the Ars Arbitel methodology with its a strange blend of pagan Gnostic archon spirits, as the Olympics, and Calvinist theology, like Calvinist theology, and that's fun. Like, who doesn't love Calvinism, right?
That's fascinating. That's absolutely fascinating. I mean, to
So,
me,
yeah.
the some of the most fascinating parts of not only Golden Dawn history but generally the occult is that or the angelical the conversations, that moment, that event that lasted all those years. But it's like a lot of people don't realize like how involved Dee was with the history of his era, working as a spy and at also court astrologer to Queen Elizabeth. I mean, that's insane. And
Unofficially unpaid.
yeah. Well, that's kind of the tragedy of Dee's life.
Oh,
You know what I
it's
mean?
more than a tragedy. Holy crap.
A penniless genius, who like
But you know,
created the British Empire.
oh, and D, but D was, I'm sure there's times he was penniless, but he wasn't generally penniless. This man, all the books, the library he collected costed money, and reading in the biographies about where he got money from and who he borrowed, like, oh, 50 pounds here, 50 pounds there. It's like if I was calling you up and other people, I'd be like, hey, can I just borrow another, like, I don't know, 15K, 15K, 10, 5 or 5 is okay, but no, maybe like 20, like you can't. He was just doing that and buying this stuff. And sometimes the queen definitely gave him money, but yeah, no official position in the early years, especially. And I think that's largely because it was sort of like, hey, a lot of people thought I should execute you because along, like your dad and brother, but I'm not going to, and you owe me, you know? So it's
Right.
like that, like I've spared your life, you owe me forever, and I'll throw you scraps. But I don't know, there's quite a mystery between, especially in those last 10 years. I don't know why Queen Elizabeth didn't do what I would consider right by him. Those last 10 years are odd, and I'm just reading the Glyn Perry academic biography now, so hopefully I'll have a better understanding there later on.
I mean, you know, his associate Edward Kelly and spending all that time and getting himself involved in all this political intrigue probably was like, what are you doing? That's the whole thing, you know, he that I love about D is that he really, you could tell, we like to retrospectively paint everybody with the same brush as, you know, that is saturated in our own colors. You know, like nobody believed anything, nobody did anything out of any sincerity other than some sort of you know, desire to climb the power hierarchy. We there's lots of TV shows and sort of, I want to say, sociopolitical philosophy that kind of rearranges everything around that central thing. And D, I think, is a really good example of somebody who did things because he believed in them. And he really, really was. His convictions were so strong that it led him to constantly kind of he kept putting his foot in it, especially in the later years. You know, because Mortlake, I think, ended up ransacked, right? I mean, his books were, a lot of the stuff was stolen or it got destroyed. And because he was away from home for so long, trying to
He
like.
wasn't sending money to his, I believe it's his wife's brother, or someone like that. He wasn't sending money to them, and so they sold a lot of his stuff to pay themselves. And he was gone for many years.
Yeah,
Our
crazy.
minds can't even imagine what that's like. Like, could you imagine, like especially with the whole thing going on with squatters these days? Can you imagine like leaving your home for like 20 years and being like, I told my neighbor to look after it for me, and he said he would. It's like, did you pay property tax? No.
Yeah,
What's that?
that's like the Odyssey. You know, you go away for, you come home and there's suitors in your house. That's, you know, I like that. I like that we have a lot in common. I like that you kind of, you know, acknowledge the Christianity that is part of it's part of the contextual basis of you know, the Angelical Sessions and D and Kelly's work. It's not something that you can easily sidestep while maintaining any kind of real hold on what was going on, at least initially, right? Like you're saying, you don't necessarily need it in order to work the system, but I think that in order to really contextualize it in a way that makes sense, it's super important. And I was very pleased to hear that. You know, I think one of the first things you had mentioned to me when we were initially dialoguing was that you're also a Christian yourself.
Yeah, I went to a seminary after I closed the temple and got my master's in divinity, and worked for the Anglican Church. I still do sort of para ecclesial work with people professionally, and that's one of the reasons I use a pseudonym.
Understandable. So, I mean, the marriage of those two things for you is not incompatible.
Not at all. Not at all. And what would you define those two things as?
Well, that's the whole
Mainstream
thing.
religion?
Well,
Because what
I
is that,
was.
right? Religion contains its esoteric aspects within it. It contains its mystical theology as a bedrock of its entire tradition. You can go appeal to scripture, you can appeal to tradition, but that any denomination you look at, it's going to have all these different elements at it, right? Like, we're looking actually, I think, at the most fertile terrain imaginable for a massive resurgence in American evangelical Christian folk magic. I mean, I think it's already begun, but like, you know, all I think a lot of the fundamentalist evangelicals who are railing against demon possessions and occultists pop stars, you know, Taylor Swift doing rituals, you know, the people are like, oh, it's all magic and stuff. Like, eventually they're going to discover the six and seven books of Moses and be like, oh, and we can do it too. A lot of them, I think, are going to find that out. Someone else, David Rankin, also thinks that. He thinks the future is going to be very heavily a big movement of psalmody and psalm-based magic in the Christian mainstream, perhaps even, though albeit not necessarily mainstream. But who
Yeah.
knows?
Well, I mean, the thing is that despite, you know, falling statistics and things like that, Christians still make up like a tremendous percentage of the population of the country that I live in. You know, and I live in the South, I used to live in the north, and Christianity is much different down here than it is up there. But that's the whole thing, people will message me, like, okay, for Easter, right? Yesterday I put up, Christ is risen. And people are like flabbergasted that I'm an occultist, and I'm also like, what's going on? Like,
Yeah, they're hard on us, aren't they?
it's you get it from everywhere, because then I'm an occultist and the Christians don't want to talk to me. So, then they find out I'm a Freemason. It's just I get, there's no rest. But the thing is that it's really, to your point, it's not, incompatible, especially when you look at, and I think even in somebody like Walter Honegraaff, who's very, very, he, he's academic about it, but he talks about it sympathetically and realistically, without this kind of this bias of wanting to whitewash mainstream religions out of it. Like what we consider occultism today had its foundations in mainstream religions. It did not exist outside of mainstream religions. Like the Western esoteric traditions, as they've been handed down to us, are firmly implanted within, that milieu. Granted, they might have been on the peripheries, but they would have had no germinative area. They would have had no seed ground to sprout up. And I mean, like, I look at my up north, the Sicilian grandmother who prays to saints if she needs to find things or if she's in trouble. I mean, it's kind of magic, So it's these things I think are very compatible, and I'm just interested to hear your thoughts on like your commentary on that. I mean, do you get that too? Do people kind of bust your chops about that?
Oh, absolutely. It was as I announced my return to the occulture in 2018 with my appearance at the Berlin Occulture Conference, and with my priest collar on and everything, performed a Kabbalistic cross with my the four Enochian tablets being held by attendees around me, and those were the same tablets from the original temple of Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn International from Cherry Lane down in L.A. Like Zinc's original tablets made by Lisa, who has recently passed, unfortunately. So those tablets are still at my friend's temple, the one of the offshoot chief temples in England. So, that was my announcement back to the scene. People were very shocked to see the collar and to hear about my background. And I was surprised that they were shocked, because I was like, I thought that's why my application was accepted, because it was kind of far out and like, oh, is this person really exists? They were lacking in hermetic presentations and stuff. And yeah, so it's shocking. It's shocking to, I guess, some people to discover that there's this magical tradition within the Christian churches. And that's just a lack of education. And again, I think Honegraaff talks about that in Esotericism and the Academy, and how since the Enlightenment, these things just sort of slowly got shoved off and discredited, even though they came from mainstream sources. Dr. Puka's recent really excellent video on cataphatic practices, cataphatic spirituality in the Christian church, identifying it as far back as the 12th century Christian pietism, right? Like, so those practices then that were very common then make their way into things like Scott's discovery of witchcraft, which then make their way into you and I tracing pentagrams in the air. Right? These are not newfangled new age ideas like people like to criticize, like detractors of our tradition, like John R. King III and others who like to, crap on the Golden Dawn. They're just ignorant as to the historical roots our tradition springs from, right? Grimoire purists who say, oh no, you must work within this grimoire, and this is the best grimoire, and I have the only unpublished copy from this manuscript, that was in Prince's vault with all his unreleased albums. Look at that's it, it's been debunked, and most people know that now, right? They know that the PGM exists. They know that a lot of the GD rituals are from this syncretic tradition that is far more ancient than perhaps even the Solomonic in its normally recognized form. So yeah, lots of fun to be had. And I think your grandma praying to a saint to find her keys is literally just as Christian as me wearing doing putting on an Anubis god form to find my keys, because Christ is king, right?
It's so funny because you said that before, and I just pictured Candace Owens working the Enochian tablets. I couldn't
Well,
get
with
the image.
AI, we could make that real.
I couldn't get out of my head.
I can't believe someone said the name Candace Owens to me on a podcast. That's something I've said a lot of crazy things on podcasts. That's actually crazier. I don't even know what to say.
Yeah,
Anyway.
man, it's well, it'll definitely affect the algorithm, that's for sure. We've got her, we've got Christ. I mean, this will get like 9 views. I love it. I love it.
I
This is
love it.
great. This is a great combo, man. I want to ask you this, and this might be a little redundant because we've talked about it a lot. We spent almost a half hour talking
I'll
before I
find a
hit
new way to answer it then.
the recording, but I want to ask you the question, since you've had that interview, if any of your thoughts have kind of like changed or anything like that. But you asked Lon Duquette why he thought Magic was having such a comeback these days. And so why do you think Magic, right? Forget Golden Dawn, because the people in Golden Dawn, we've been doing it for a long time, especially you, like hats off, because it's commitment, right? A lot of people don't stick around one thing for that long, but so what are your thoughts, maybe, I don't know, sociologically, metaphysically, what are you thinking? What's the purpose, the telos maybe behind this resurgence of Magic?
You know, well, I've never been one to really have any kind of perusal expectations of some epic event or return, whether it's the return of Christ or some black swan nightmare, whatever that would be. Like, I like to imagine. I was a big fan when I actually had time and young and those carefree days of summer childhood, and playing second edition Shadowrun. I always had this sense intuitively that the world would go into some sort of like cyber future, and that this I had this sort of vision or image in my mind that the idea that like because we were all terrified of Y2K. Right. Everyone's like, Y2K, Y2K. I even first year college in magazine article writing class, I wrote for my professor an article that I still like, actually. It's called Y2K. Did you forget your umbrella? And it's just all about like demons falling from the sky. And, you got to have your umbrella and all the different uses an umbrella will have. I'd never read Douglas Adams. I've never read Douglas Adams or anything like that. That was just sort of my style of writing naturally as a kid. And he liked that a lot because everyone was terrified. We shut down all of our Vancouver. 2000 year 2000 celebrations in Vancouver and had a vigil of light with candles near Science World. And it was so sad. Buses were getting shut down because someone would forget their backpack. It's like, oh, we're all gonna die, right? And we had to sit there in Vancouver and watch as the other time zones across from like, from like Russia, Moscow, fireworks and dancing, Vienna, fireworks and dancing or waltzing. France, fireworks and dancing. America, fireworks, dancing and gun violence. And then get to Toronto and it's like, fireworks and I don't know what Torontonians are like, but then it gets to Vancouver and it's like you see this image on the news and it's like really dark because nothing's happening and there's some buildings around them. And then you see some flickers of light. And it's like, yeah, this is 60 people that showed up to our city's event for the year 2000. And there's a reason. So that's. If you ever hear people refer to our city as No Fun Coover, that's sort of part of the reason why. Our city has a problem with fun, but the people don't. And we do want to we used to be the most artistic city in Canada. We had the top amount of artists in Canada, with the second highest per capita being Victoria, just on Vancouver Island. So our province had the two highest cap per capita collections of artists. Since the Olympics, it's gone down to it's just become garbage. They just destroyed a city. The cost, like, artists can't afford $3,500 for a bachelor suite, like, yeah. And there's just, yeah. So it's really, I think it's those times. It's these end time mentalities. And then when the end times doesn't happen, it creates this new questioning. And we see this, I think, in other centuries as well, with when you sort of look at the upspring of religious movements and spiritual beliefs and different traditions, right? There's the one before the millennium and the one after the millennium. And then there's sort of this dead zone in the middle, it seems like to me. Though the more I learn about history, the more I realize maybe that's just never the case. Honestly, if I was to give an answer, like speaking academically, though maybe that's not true, I don't know, I just said that. But like, if I was to answer it to academics, I would say I suspect that this tradition has always been just as lively and prominent as it is now. It's just been documented well or poorly or marginalized more or less at certain times. But I don't think that the quantity of people really has changed. That's not to say this is, but this is what we're going through now is totally different. This occult revolution and what's causing that, well, disempowering people. Yeah, disempowering people, taking their autonomy away from them and government, and putting them under the boot on their neck. That's going to make people, magic is there for, is I in my experience, magic is best at doing things that you can't do in any other way. That's why people who do magic try to make a living off doing magic for money, literally aren't going to ever succeed at that. You can't live off praying at an altar for money or doing spells for money. Well, unless you're a service and selling it as a service, I suppose. And I do appreciate the people that do that, actually. Sometimes it's nice to, avail yourself. Like when you're putting on a big event.
Yeah, there you go. Well, why don't you, is there anything else that you can tell us about the Enochia Con? Maybe the dates and some of the people. I mean, you're giving a presentation, right?
Yeah, of course. Of course. Yeah, I've made a remarkable discovery that will change the face of Enochian magic for all of time.
Oh boy. So
Yeah.
I'm not gonna ask you to tease it here,
We
but
should we you know, I mean, well, I mean you could. I literally have run my discovery by well, I needed some help and I got advice and then I took the advice and then the person said, actually ignore that advice, let me help you some more. And so that was Joseph Peterson, who of course is nothing if nothing but helpful. And he helped me confirm that what I found was indeed what I thought it was. And then I passed it by Dr. Burns to see what she thought. She thought it was significant. And then I passed it by Dr. Angela Puka to see what she thought. And she thought that it was something I could get published academically. So that's what I'm going to do with my little discovery. But you guys will hear about it first at the conference before I submit the article to an academic journal. So yeah, I'm very excited for my presentation. I don't actually expect to do, I wasn't going to do a presentation this year, but then it turned out I had a reason to. I was just going to put on the event because I want these things to happen. And if we don't make them happen, they're just never going to happen. And so I'm excited to have something to contribute. And after, almost 30 years of studying Enochian magic and practicing it in varying degrees, over time, it's like pretty cool when you actually observe something that is significant, because usually that just means that you have to have so much familiarity with your field that you know what is significant.
yes.
Other people have seen what I've seen, they just didn't click how important it was. So that's what I'll be presenting on. There's going to be a lot of great presenters there. We're doing it the weekend, of course, of July 12th to 14th in Vancouver, Canada, but it's also a cyber conference. Everything's online, it's all the same price, and that's because people traveling here have to pay for travel, and that's expensive. And we have great presenters. You yourself applied and you're presenting yourself. And it would be cool to have you on the podcast sometime later this month to talk about it. But we do have till the 4th of this month a payment plan available. So you can pay the over 3 months rather than pay all at once for those who want to do that. And you should do that because it will support us and make it possible to make this thing fully happen. If it has to be just an online conference, then it will be, but it will be a physical in-person conference eventually, if not this year, then others. And I trust the magic being done. I trust the readings we've done. I think things are going to work out fine, but please do support it. If you want to see more physical events happen, see more bridges being built between practitioners and academics, sharing of information, there's just so much that we could do in this life if we are willing to put in the work to get out of our homes and go do it.
Yeah, that's a good point, especially now. Especially now.
Especially now. Do it now before it's right. In 2006, my buddy had a friend who was said he was closing down 11 mines, and my buddy said, why? He said, because there's something coming. Spend your money while it's still worth something. And then the 2008 crash happened, right? And I hear a lot of people saying, like, look, if you want to go on a cruise, if you want to go see Italy, if you want to go find yourself in Nepal or visit New Zealand, do it now, right? Because we don't actually know what's going to happen. And there's definitely dark forces at play.
Well said. Well said, my friend. So where can they go to check it out? What's the website?
EnochiaCon.com, EnochiaCon.com, and you can also check out, it's the same website as ArcaneResearchSociety.com, ArcaneResearchSociety.com. Both take you to the same place. So we're doing it as a private group, so we have access to better venues and better prices, and also avoid the whole public scrutiny of people who would just try and get it canceled before it happens. Because that is, I know so many friends who, like, as soon as they announce an event, people are calling the venue and trying to get it canceled just because they have nothing else to do with their lives. And they're just pathetic, miserable people. And there's a lot of people I know who are doing that to occultists these days. It's very common. I deal with stuff like that all the time. Dr. Puka had her whole channel DDS attacked and stuff, like massive. There's horrible, horrible attacks against occultists. And like Justin Sledge was saying on his channel, there's like outright bigotry and prejudice against any of us from alternative religions or spiritualities of that aren't the approved sort, right? And so we have a an uphill battle, and I think the best thing we can do is create our own, fortify our own connections and events and make them fun. I'm also excited to do an event where academics and practitioners are can both mix, and that's with that as the premise of the event. No one's going to have a problem with it, right? My time going to academic conferences, it was always in hushed tones. We would talk about actual spiritual experience or spiritual practices, and we would make sure we did that away from a lot of other people. And yeah, so
That's important
doing
work.
something different.
That's
Yeah.
important work. I respect that. I'm really happy to be a part of the conference, not just because of that, but that's a huge factor. I'm really glad that you got to come on today. As you probably know, I give everybody a couple canned questions at the end of the conversation. So, for anybody that's listening to this podcast today, we've talked about Golden Dawn. We've talked about John Dee. We've talked about Enochian versus the angelic magic. What three books could you recommend to anybody who wants to get a foot in the door and learn a little bit more, expand on what we talked about today? You've got a lot behind you, so.
Yeah. Can you narrow it down at all?
Yeah, maybe like a
Well, if
really
you're
good
interested
resource.
in Enochian magic,
There you go.
this is the first place to start, I would say. These diaries are not the full John Dee and Edward Kelly diaries, but they are the beginning. And more excitingly than anything else I could say about them is the new edition from Joseph Peterson comes out this August, which will be expanded, presumably with information from the document released last year from the British Library that had a different version of the Heptarchia. So the Exarchiti to Heptarchia manuscript should add some new information. I don't really know what he's doing exactly. As soon as he helped me out, actually, we discovered he played Celtic music as well. So after that, Peterson and I just talked about Irish hand drums and fiddles, and that's all we talk about now. So I hoped we could have an Enochian dialogue, but unfortunately, Celtic music trumps even Enochiana. So a new edition of this coming out, that's very much a good place to start. If you're reading the diaries as well, I recommend when you're reading the interactions, read them out loud. Same rule as poetry. And then after that, of course, the second set of diaries is published by Skinner with all the Latin translations, and you can get that on Amazon in a slightly different form, but same book. And just reading them is very interesting, in my opinion. So there's some Enochian stuff. What else could I recommend?
Is there like one that you'd is there one you'd give to somebody that's interested in Golden Dawn or?
Yeah, well, what do we got here? I've never shown this before to anyone.
Ooh.
This is one of the rare first editions.
Oh, wow, that's awesome.
What is this? You'll also Yeah. So, yeah. This is from 1994, and this is a limited first edition of.
Bam. Oh,
Yeah.
wow. That's great. Yep. Golden Dawn Rituals. Yeah, Pat Zaleski.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I can see why he reprinted it because this is missing about 60 pages.
Really? As like just a printing error?
I don't know. Another chunk of the pages, once you get to the next number, start going in reverse order. So it's definitely a novelty item.
Wow. Very cool. Very cool.
But that book has be I pointed out not just to show a make a joke and show a novelty production of a legendary text, but the new edition is out, published by Nick Farrell, and the Golden Dawn Rituals and Commentaries is definitely the place you want to read first if you're a Golden Dawn person. The Regardi Black Brick later on, I would say, with and the Cicero books, but that represents a pre-Regardi tradition of the GD before that's more full. It's just more full. And you get to, Nick, Pat Zaleski tells his story of how he found them and all of that. And it's really interesting. So yeah, you can check out from Lord Manticore Press, Nick Farrell's publication of Pat Zaleski's Golden Dawn Rituals and Commentary. The newest edition is the best edition. It's very big, and yeah, definitely a certainly a good compliment to the GD Black Brick by Regardi.
Yeah, I love Pat's take on energetics, and his experience as a martial artist and stuff like that, bringing that into the temple, because as I mentioned earlier, Taoism and Qigong and stuff like that, that's been a parallel trajectory with Golden Dawn magic for me. So yeah, I mean, that's a great recommendation. All your recommendations and all the volumes you have are awesome.
If I could only have two books on a desert island, they would have to be these two. My first edition of The Kybalion and the best magic book ever written.
Wait, so why do you have a
That's an inside joke.
why do you have a first edition of the Kybalion?
It was given to me in 1997 when I went for my Zelator initiation in LA by my friend Fratter C. You can see it's inscribed to me from that day in August 1997.
Wow.
And
I see. Wow.
there you go. I made him sign it to me and he asked why. He said he didn't want to sign it because it was a first edition. And I said, well, that way I can never sell it. And I'm glad I did make him do that because I totally would have sold it by now otherwise. I've had people offer me 10 grand for this. Like it's just. It's a
Yeah,
first edition.
I was about to say you have like a mini Mortlake going on there.
I did. I actually had a much large, I had a very large, all of this library, almost without exception, is very new since most of it since COVID. I had a 6,000 book library before that, but I had a massive robbery by one of Griffin's members and lost hundreds of thousands of dollars of property, which he's currently selling online. You can buy my old stolen books currently online from Dean McNeil.
Oh my God. That's awful.
Yeah.
That is
Yeah,
awful.
I don't know why the police think it's okay, but apparently they support criminals now over citizens, and that's the way of the world.
Yes, that's definitely going on
And
with.
I'm not just saying that to be cute. They literally said that.
Yeah, no, I
It's
believe
really weird. I don't understand what's going on anymore. I don't get it.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, man. I am right there with you. It is beyond wild. We have stepped into, and that's, that kind of goes back to the whole thing with magic coming to the fore again. But is there anything else that you want to plug, you want people to know about or anything at the
Well,
moment?
obviously, everyone needs to get Samuel Scarborough's Complete Flying Rules. You want to understand what Golden Dawn Adepts magic actually looked like in practice? You need to read these,
Yes.
right? It might be hard to understand on its own terms, in isolation from everything else, but it's a, yeah, it's very good.
That's excellent. I agree with that. I appreciate you coming on today, and I'm looking forward, really, honestly, to many future conversations, man. I feel like I'm just happy that we met, and I'm looking forward to
Likewise.
seeing you in July. Yeah, and maybe, at a future podcast, we'll dive a little bit more into music because that's a common another area of common ground.
Well, let's have you on mine on this month. Let's have you on mine this month, and we'll talk about your presentation. You can tell people about what you're going to bring to the conference, and that's going to be very exciting. We could do a Magic Without Fears classic long haul 3-4 hour one if you want. Like the record's held by Lenny Peterson at just over 6 hours, right? So that's insane. I'm sure I'll never do that again in my life, but I would. But maybe I don't know. But it is fun to spend a long time and really dive into these things. I have fans who still tell me that they only listen to the podcasts I do that are over 3 hours. It's like if it doesn't hit the 3 hour mark, it's like just not a waste of time. I'm like, you're killing me. But God bless you. I feel the same way about a lot of things. Like, I just yeah, life's busy again now. We're all back at life. So yeah, there's just not necessarily time to always do those same deep dives. I was very happy when you applied. Because I reached out to you just to see if you'd have me on because I loved your Dr. Sledge interview so much. I thought you did that, handled that with, you really got out of him some stuff I have not seen him, a side of him that I've not seen him express in that way. And it was really heartwarming and showed his, I think his showed his humanity and his intellectual integrity in a way that a lot of people might not appreciate if they're just watching his the content he puts out. Yeah, so I hope people, I hope a lot, I hope that's a very popular episode because it should be. Yeah. And with them when so yeah, I just reached out to be on because I wanted to talk to you and be on your podcast. And then you applied and I was so excited that you did. That's really wonderful. I look forward to showing you this beautiful, amazing city of Vancouver this summer.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.